This is an interview with Governor Victor Atiyah at the his office in downtown Portland, Oregon. The interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society is Clark Hansen. The date is July 24th, 1993, and this is tape 50, side one.
To continue with the Bhagwan, let me tell you that we had pretty good intelligence because we were really concerned. We knew what firearms they had. We knew pretty much how many bullets they had.
How did you know these things?
Oh, just by intelligence. You check around, you find out where, you know.
Who was doing that for you?
State police. And also the U.S. attorney. And this was a pretty well coordinated effort. Probably one of the few times in which the city, county, state, and federal government all worked together. Mm-hmm. Usually, that's a frustrating thing. They don't always work together.
So you were working then with all these other groups then?
Yes. We had a task force. And I should include the Attorney General's office, which is Dave Crowley. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's sources of who's selling bullets and who's selling guns, and we had some intelligence on the ranch itself. And we had intelligence, and we were worried. And the thing got quite volatile, and Oregonians mm-hmm. were very angry. And we had plans, for example, and these are only by way of example. You know, we thought, well, we have to worry about some Oregonian. They get really mad, and we really get pretty much upset, particularly during hunting season. You know, they would shoot a Rajneesh.
Who would shoot at Rajneesh?
Some Oregonian got mad. An Oregonian. These are all what ifs.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay.
That's what they are.
This is just a hypothetical situation.
That's
it didn't actually exist.
No, it didn't happen.
Okay.
We even had thought, well, now wait a minute. These folks might themselves shoot the Bhagwan and then make a martyr out of him and then accuse Oregonians of having done so. Those are among the things we worried about.
Right.
As it came to even later stages, I had the National Guard training up at Redmond. The training, they had helicopters and personnel carriers, and we had them training.
I think you said at the very beginning of our interview series that during this period you had with you an emergency.
Executive orders.
Executive order.
Right.
And you carried that with you 24 hours a day.
Yes. Still have as a souvenir. No matter where I was. And all the while, that was the confidential side of this. Mm-hmm. On the public side, I'm trying to keep it cool. Mm-hmm. And then the politicians, they take shots at the Rajneesh, and that was a very popular thing to do. Mm-hmm. But I'd get very upset because I'm trying to keep it cool, and they're turning up the heat.
Did you inform the legislature about the things that you were doing?
No. It's strictly internal all the way.
Was there any consideration of doing that?
No. It wasn't a matter of keeping them out. It was just a matter that we had to limit who knew what it was that we were doing. Too many leaky boats, and we just, you know, the media would say, okay, Governor, what are you doing? I said, well, we're ready for them, no matter what they do. But what are you doing? I said, I'm not going to tell you. And you'd think they would understand that. They don't ask the question. Because I'm not going to tell them. If I tell them, I'm telling the Rajneesh, and I don't want to tell the Rajneesh. During this period of time was this negotiation, Jerry Thompson and Bob Oliver. And meaning the Rajneesh, were trying to do a quid pro quo with me on their court case, which relate to land use planning. And, for example, if the governor would back off on the court case, then we will not bring any more homeless. I'm not sure that it came out that way, or we won't do whatever it is they were doing. And Jerry Thompson said, because she knew me, it came up, cold one time, she reported, but she knows me. And the first time, this the governor does not trade. You're coming about this all the wrong way.
Yeah.
They didn't believe that, because that's the way their life was. And she said to them, because I kept saying, Jerry, you tell them, no matter what they do, we're going to be ready for them. So this took maybe, I've forgotten, over the course of, I don't know, I can't tell you a time frame, 2, 3, 4 months, I don't remember, and 2 or 3 meetings. All I can tell you is that when they finally came to the realization that, number one, I wasn't going to trade, and number two, they really believed that we were ready for whatever it is they wanted to do, that's when it began to unravel. That's when things began to fall apart.
Do you think that was the reason?
I think that's the only reason I can think of. That's the only clue, because I know they came to the realization by this constant reminder by Jerry Thompson and Bob Oliver that they weren't going to get away with anything.
What do you think that they were hoping to accomplish?
I have no idea what their final objective was. Maybe they wanted their own state. I don't know. But anyway.
How many people were out there at the peak?
Oh, I can't remember. Peak meaning permanent, probably, you're saying. There were several thousand on a permanent basis, and then of course it swelled during their encampment or whatever they call their thing.
Right, 10,000-12,000 people,
oh,
I think.
A bunch of them.
Yeah.
But then it began to unravel, and that's when the Bhagwan took off, and he got picked up on the East Coast, and Sheila takes off, and what I always knew was going to happen, these cults always go away, always. You just don't know how long it's going to take to happen. That's what finally happened.
Well, Sheila left the commune and went into hiding in September 85, I believe. And didn't Rajneesh actually link the former leaders at that point with a major outbreak of salmonella poisoning in the Dalles? Wasn't he the one that said that?
That was the beginning of all of that. There was the final link of that.
And there was a fire at the Wasco County Planning Office.
Yeah.
And putting chemicals in the law enforcement vehicles at the Dalles so that they wouldn't run, and with planting electronic bugs in rooms and telephones, including Rajneesh's bedroom.
Oh, yeah.
And attempting to poison his doctor and dentist and companion.
Yeah. All of these things.
And the Jefferson County District Attorney and the water system in the Dalles. It really sounded like an incredible, it was really escalating out of control.
During this time, we weren't training it, right?
You ordered the State Department of Justice to investigate allegations that departed leaders of the Rajneesh community tried to kill Jefferson County DA Michael Sullivan. Was that with poison?
Or I'm not sure how they planned to kill him, but that was, and Dave Fillmore was on their list as well, and Norma Paulus was on their list.
Really? Really? I don't think that ever made the news, did it?
I think Dave Frohmeyer did.
Uh-huh. Major Robert Moyne, the district state police commander at Bend, said the wiretapping installations uncovered, quote, were possibly the largest wiretapping incident in the history of any nation.
Yeah.
Of course, there was the Soviet Union, which probably...
Well, he maybe did get carried away, but it was a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And then in October of 85, Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh was arrested in North Carolina, as you said, attempting to flee the U.S. Rajneesh's lawyers knew of secret arrest warrants. How did the government know that they were leaving, and how did they know about these secret arrest warrants? And what contingency plans did the government have?
I can't give it all to you, and it's not a matter of not putting it on tape.
Uh-huh.
I don't know them all. That's why, really, I think somebody could get into a book writing by talking to Turner, talking to Norman Paulus, Dave Frohmeyer, Jerry Thompson, Bob mm-hmm. Oliver. We've got notes on all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they were. I say close to. They were close to what went on.
They were
almost face to face at times. And I know Jerry Thompson and the rest were, where I was deliberately standing back up here and did this very deliberately. And so when you come to, and I would say General Miller, the National Guard, you know, that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
That there were there, a book, really a book could be written about this whole thing. I think there have been some interviews. I've not seen any books on it. So I've been interviewed. Somebody wants to write a book. But there's a good book there. As we know, Sheila was one of them that was indicted, tried, and found guilty and went to jail.
And she's serving, is she still serving time?
No, she's out. She's out, and it was kind of a disappointment because she still owes the state money. And I think Neil Goldschmidt just, without telling the Attorney General's office, said, okay, you can turn her loose, and they turned her loose, and she took off.
How did they capture her? It was in Germany or something, wasn't it?
Yeah. We went through a period of time of extradition between countries. That's difficult, you know. It's relatively easy extradition between states, but you deal between countries is a little more difficult. Mm-hmm.
And there was plea bargaining regarding her session.
That's right.
Sentence.
Yeah.
What happened to Rancho Rajneesh? The main body of land.
Well, just finally went away.
It was thousands of acres, wasn't it?
Yeah. They sold all the cars to one guy in Texas, I think, bought them all. That is the Rolls Royce. Dismantled, sold the portable housing, and most recent. And incidentally, the mortgage was owed to one of the big insurance companies, and so they took it.
Mm-hmm.
They think they finally sold it fairly recently to somebody. The ranch was for sale, and it was finally sold.
Wasn't there? So the state repossessed it. Didn't they for their...
No, because the insurance company had the mortgage on it.
Ah, right, right. Wasn't there some talk about the state taking it over and making it into
a
prison?
Norma had some kind of a deal with education, and there was always talk about making a prison out there. Not an appropriate place for either one of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or a resort.
Hmm?
Or a resort or something like that.
Well, I'm not sure. Oh, a dude ranch kind of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Central Oregon. You could probably take a few patches and a few acres and pour a lot of water on and have something grow. But commercially for a large ranch, it's cattle, and there's probably I don't know how many acres per cow out there, but a lot of acres per cow, and it's just not productive in the sense of. Milk and honey, that's all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else regarding this incident, this story, this part of Oregon's history that, they referred to this as been the only time when something like this has happened, but of course, earlier in the century, there was the incident with the Holy Rollers.
Oh, yeah. We've had cults in Oregon more than once. I don't think we've ever had a cult quite as bracing as these people.
Of course, now we've got the Aryan, some of the Aryan
nation. Well,
fortunately,
they're in Idaho. I say fortunately. I don't want to wish any of that on anybody. But,
yeah.
At least the governor of Oregon doesn't have to worry about those people. I worry about those kind of people. That's where we, way back when I told you I asked for racial and religious harassment to be a felony. These bullies, these neo-Nazis, the white supremacists, I think they're terrible, awful people. And obviously we certainly must have some of them in Oregon, but I guess you'd say headquarters of that kind of thing is in Idaho.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
Anything else about this episode?
No, I think maybe just to repeat, because I think it's worthy of repeating, that to me, this was a great test of a democracy. Well, how much do you believe?
A great test of democracy.
Yeah. How much do you really believe in it? I didn't like them. I wish they hadn't been there. I didn't need that worry. My dislike for them was as intense as any Oregonian was. And yet, they were entitled to equal protection, like any other citizen. On the other hand, I insisted that they abide the laws equally. In other words, there was going to be no special treatment for or against. It would be evenly applied. It was a test. Gosh, some really nice people and the people that I know are responsible. And obviously, they were very close to it. Wanted something done about these people. But this is a democracy. Mm-hmm. And in a democracy, these things happen. Like I mentioned, he went back to India, the Bhagwan did. They kick him out. Well, they can do that in India. We can't do that in the United States. So you take it as it comes. You believe in it. I had no doubt it was going to go away. I didn't know when it was going to go away, but I knew it was going to go away. Just no culture going to go away. Mm-hmm. I wondered why people would give their lives up to this guy. Humorous sidelight. Went down to Albany. Parade.
Mm-hmm.
And, gosh, what was it? Maybe the Timber Carnival Parade or something. So I'm waiting in line. They're waiting for the parade to get started. These guys come up with me, and they put beads around my neck. These were chestnuts, and they had a picture of Alfred P. Newman. You know,
oh, right.
Yeah. That was, I
from
think I
Mad Magazine.
I have that, you know. So here I had my own beads with Alfred P. Newman instead of the Bhagwan. And once in a while you had a little joke out of it.
But it must have been a lot of pressure for you.
Yeah, it was. It was. In the sense that there was a lot of misunderstanding about my role and what I was doing. But I was protecting Oregonians, but we had to do it in a very silent sense. You know, it was not a public sense. And those politicians were free to swing in any direction they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have the responsibility that I had, at least that I felt that I had. And here, as I say, I'm trying to keep it calm, and they're stirring the pot. And I know it was a good political thing to do, was to stir the pot, politically for them, but it certainly wasn't a responsible thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But you just persist in doing what you think is the right thing to do. I suppose that's where a good grounding in what your belief in the system of government is. A real test of what, you know, you really get tested. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing is to say you believe it, and the other is get tested to see if you believe it. I didn't really consider it a test. I mean, to me, it was just one of those things. There was no question that we were going to do what was what our democracy called for.
Well, maybe then we could go on to the next category here of things that happened outside of the legislature, and that was the Oregon Investment Council. We haven't talked really much about that. What is the role of the Oregon Investment Council?
Are we on or off?
We're on.
Okay. The funds of the public employees retirement system goes in. And I believe there are other funds, I'm trying to recall, state funds. And the investment council does pretty much what it says. We invest the funds to the benefit of the, in this case, the public employees retirement fund. They really have done a superb job. The return to the retired workers has been really absolutely sensational. At times I say, gee whiz, I'd like to put my money in there, have those folks manage my money for me. Roger Meyer really was he was really a full-time volunteer. Bright, brilliant guy in this field. I think put them on the path that such a, measured such a large return.
He was the chairman of the council for a long time, wasn't he?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And who else was on the council? How was it composed? State Treasurer Bill Rutherford was on there.
State Treasurer is on.
And then there were four persons appointed by the governor and the Public Employees Retirement System Board.
There's a seat there for the Public Employees Retirement. There were designated seats, and then some seats just not designated.
Designated for a certain purpose?
Well,
or
the Public Employees Representative.
Uh-huh.
That's what I mean.
Right.
The State Treasurer. And I'm trying to remember the makeup of it all. Really a limited number of what you'd call open or free seats on that. Mm-hmm. Roger was one of those open or free seats. At one point I was thinking of appointing Bob Straub, but I needed an assurance that he would be, I'm trying to think of the technicality, but that it had to be the public employees had to appoint him or something. Mm-hmm. It was a particular seat that had to be appointed. I wasn't assured of that, so I didn't take the step.
There were some issues that came up during the time you were governor, and I thought maybe we could go over a couple of those.
Fine.
One of them was that Roger Meyer agreed to serve as a director of Fred Meyer after the council invested $178 million for KKNR, Colbert, Kravitz, and Roberts.
Yeah.
That had the leverage buyout of Fred Meyer, and took the appointment without the consent of the council, which I believe he was supposed to. They discouraged members from getting involved with potential investment opportunities, and that was looked upon not favorably at the time. What was your feeling about it?
Well, first of all, I wasn't concerned about what would be called a conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm.
Second, Roger doesn't need the money. By that, when I say that to you, it doesn't matter that money would influence him. If he were getting a board fee, whatever that board fee is, they can't give enough. He's got enough. He doesn't have to worry personally about trying to make money. Third. He had done such a remarkably good job for the public employees for such a long period of time that there was no doubt in my mind of his commitment to the retirement fund. It always became his baby, if you know what I'm trying to say.
Right.
And that there was no way in the world he was going to be influenced with anything that would be detrimental to the fund. So when you ask me, I'm perfectly comfortable. I have no qualms about him or any conflict of interest. I felt perfectly safe, perfectly comfortable with it.
But what about the public perception?
Perception? Perception is perception. There's not much you can do about that.
But perception is something that someone in your position has to consider when you're in politics. And when you're dealing with appointments, that people may not have the understanding of Roger Meyer that you have.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But here again, was I going to get rid of someone that was a positive force for good in the retirement fund because of perception? My answer was no. Now, this would have been, I think, would have been a disservice to the retirement fund.
Were you getting input from the retirement fund in regards to this issue?
In regard to Roger?
Mm-hmm.
I can't recall. Mm-hmm.
I imagine you were probably getting input from other groups.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Another issue that came up was regarding State Treasurer Bill Rutherford. First of all, what was your impression of him? We haven't talked about him at all.
No, we haven't.
Why do you laugh?
Well, I appointed him, and the question was, should I appoint him? At the time, he was going to run to fill that vacancy.
Uh huh. And why did you appoint Bill Rutherford?
I thought he was a good man for that job.
Did he ever run for re-election?
No, he quit, as a matter of fact, which was a disappointment to him.
He went to New York, didn't he? And there was some question about revolving door appointments.
Well, that too is something I don't worry about as much.
Mm-hmm.
Let me divert from Bill for a moment. Mm-hmm. There was always this, what you call revolving door, that you, or the other side was, well, it's the same side. If you take a job with the state government, you can't take another job that relates to that for a year or 2 years or something like that. And I think that's wrong. I think it's wrong as it can be. We want good people. We want good people. And the kind of person you would get would say, okay, I'll take that job and I won't go back. I'm not sure that's the kind of person I want. I want a person that's demanded on the outside, has demand on the outside. That means that in his case, the financial world, thinks he has some great ability. And that to me is a signal that this is a good man for the job that I want.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's damaging to our process to make those kinds of demands on people. You can't get the best person for the job then. If he thinks by taking a job with the state, now he's at a dead end.
Right.
That's not the kind of person I want to take it.
But isn't there a difference between being in a dead end situation and being in a temporary block in a certain direction that might, if used wrongly, create conflicts of interest by they're making certain decisions that would then affect their future source of employment, potential sources of employment.
There is that. However, if one were to follow that theory, no lawyer should ever be in the legislature. No teacher should ever be in the legislature. No businessman should ever be in the legislature. No labor union guy should ever be in the legislature. What else can I think of? You see what I'm trying to get at?
True, and yet legislators are people who are one of many people in that group that make a decision that a majority of them have to come to agreement upon. Whereas people that are in appointed positions or elected positions, such as a state treasurer, they're making sole decisions that could affect. Of course, they're under the governor, but they're to some extent. But they're making sole decisions, which are not necessarily those that are voted upon by any group.
The major element that the Treasury deals with is really the investment council and the public employees retirement fund. That is not a single decision by that person.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all done in public meetings. They deal with other funds of state government. I'll go all the way back to a discussion we had very early on when I was appointing my head of the energy department, Kelly Woods, and they turned him down because he had some Pacific Power stock and he knew something about nuclear power plants. And I had a phone conversation, and I remember we talked about this, with a very well-equipped person to be head of the Energy Department. And I asked him if he had stock, and I asked him if he had any... Anyway, after 5 or 10 minutes of that kind of conversation, he said, Governor, seems to me that you're looking for somebody that doesn't know anything or doesn't own anything. And I paused and I kind of laughed. I said, gee, was that sure? It sounds like it's right. And now let's bounce back to where we are right now. The threat, the potential of mischief certainly is there. That's what you're suggesting. And yet, the best thing we can do for state government, because a person is a citizen. I mean, see, so many of them say, I don't need that. I'm doing okay.
Right.
I don't need to do that. But you keep trying to attract good people